There is a fifth dimension beyond that which is known to man. It is a dimension as vast as space and as timeless as infinity. It is the middle ground between light and shadow, between science and superstition, and it lies between the pit of man's fears and the summit of his knowledge. This is the dimension of imagination. It is an area which we call the Twilight Zone.
In a bank. A bespectacled teller counts out bills and hands them to a customer.
One.
Below the counter, on his lap, is an opened book.
Mrs. Chester, have you ever read David Copperfield?
How's that?
It's a wonderful book. It's this poor little fellow, you know, his father has passed away, and his mother's married this miserable man called Murdstone. Isn't that a villainous name? Murdstone. Well, this Murdstone has a sister called Jane.
Mr. Bemis, you shortchanged me again. You owe me one more dollar. See? There's only 24 here, and there should be 25.
Oh, I'm terribly sorry, Mrs. Chester. I thought there were five ones. There was only four. I thought I'd given you five. I'm terribly sorry. And then there's another very funny character here called Micawber, Mr. Micawber. And he's always being sent to debtor's prison. And then there's another wonderful character
she walks
here
off.
Called Peggotty. That is David's nurse.
He looks up, and his customer is gone.
Oh, dear.
He places in front of him a sign saying, "Next window, please," and resumes reading David Copperfield. A man stands behind him with raised eyebrows. Bemis turns to look at him.
Yes, sir.
I wonder if I might see you in my office, Mr. Bemis.
Why, certainly, Mr. Carswell. I don't suppose you've ever read David Copperfield, have you?
No, Mr. Bemis, I have not. Now, if you'll be good enough to accompany me.
Witness Mr. Henry Bemis, a charter member in the Fraternity of Dreamers. A bookish little man whose passion is the printed page, but who is conspired against by a bank president and a wife and a world full of tongue cluckers and the unrelenting hands of a clock. But in just a moment, Mr. Bemis will enter a world without bank presidents, or wives, or clocks, or anything else. He'll have a world all to himself, without anyone.
Behind a door labeled President.
Now, Mr. Bemis, I shall come to the point of this interview. I shall arrive via the following route, which is namely, what constitutes an efficient member of this organization? Viz, a bank teller who knows his job and performs it. I.e., an organization man who functions within an organization. You, Mr. Bemis, do not function within the organization. You are neither an efficient bank teller nor a proficient employee.
Standing up.
You, Mr. Bemis, are a reader.
A reader?
A reader.
Yes.
A reader of books, magazines, periodicals, newspapers. I see you constantly going downstairs into the vault during your lunch hour. Ultimatum, Mr. Bemis.
Yes, sir.
You will henceforth devote your time to your job and forget reading, or you'll find yourself outdoors on a park bench reading from morning till night for want of having a job. Do I make myself perfectly clear?
Oh, that's perfectly clear, sir. It's just that...
Just that what, Bemis? Make it quick and get back to your cage.
It's just that my wife won't let me read at home. See, when I get home at night and try to pick up a newspaper, she yanks it out of my hand. And then after dinner, if I try to find a magazine, she hides them. Well, I got so desperate that I found myself trying to read the labels on the condiment bottles on the table. Now, she won't even let me use the ketchup.
The bank president smiles.
Unasked, I give my reaction to this. Your wife is an amazingly bright woman. I remember last November you spent the better part of the days reading campaign buttons on customers' lapels. You will recall, Bemis, the young lady who took considerable exception to this and tried to hit you with her umbrella.
Yes, I remember that. It's just that I never got a chance to tell her that I was only looking to see who she voted for.
Good day, Bemis.
He sits down. holding onto the doorknob, Bemis bends down to thumb through a stack of periodicals on an adjacent table. Bemis smiles and backs out the door. Later, Bemis sits in an armchair reading a newspaper.
Henry! Henry!
Yes, dear, I'm in the living room.
His wife storms in, snatches the paper out of his hands.
You want more coffee or don't you?
No, thank you, dear.
Well, then why don't you tell me that? And don't sneak off into the living room to bury yourself in newsprint. I think we've been over this quite enough, Henry. I won't tolerate a husband of mine sacrificing the art of conversation. All right. What's so funny?
No, 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 dear. It was just that you said a husband of mine. Well, how many husbands have you got? You've only got me.
I would appreciate that not being rubbed in. We're playing cards tonight. I want you to change your shirt. We're going over to the Phillips house.
Oh, dear.
All right, Henry. Anything to say?
No, dear, nothing to say.
Removing his glasses.
What time are we due there?
In about 15 minutes.
And putting them back on.
All right, I'll be ready on time.
See that you are.
She walks out of the room. Bemis gets up. Then turns back and lifts the cushion on the armchair. He reaches underneath and digs and unearths a paperback. He holds the book in one hand as he puts on his tie with the other, slides the book into the inner pocket of his jacket, pulls the jacket on and opens the door, behind which stands his wife.
Henry?
Yes, my dear?
She glances down and steps toward him.
What have you got, Henry?
Got?
Got.
Nothing, my dear.
She reaches under his jacket, pulls out the book.
What's this?
What the heck?
This.
Isn't that odd? Now, how did that get here?
I can only hazard a guess. A book of modern poetry. Yours, Henry?
He nods once.
Would you like to read me some?
Leading him by the elbow.
Read you some. Do you mean read you out loud out of the book?
Do you want to?
Oh, I would love to. No, there are some lovely things in here.
They sit on the couch.
There are one or two things from T.S. Eliot and Edmondson, Vincent Millay, Robert Frost, Carl Sandburg.
He opens the book, flips through the pages. Every page is obliterated with scribbles.
Helen.
Standing up and looking at her.
Who did this, Helen?
Who do you think did it, Henry? You should thank me, really. A grown man who reads silly, ridiculous, nonsensical doggerel.
This isn't doggerel. There's some very beautiful things here.
I say it's doggerel. I also say it's a waste of time.
Grabbing the book,
Helen,
she rips the pages
out, one by one.
Helen,
please don't do
He leans over to pick up the pages, and his glasses fall to the floor. He puts his glasses back on and picks up a clump of pages.
Why, Helen? Why do you do these things?
Because I'm married to a fool.
She goes out. He kneels on the floor and gathers up the ruined pages. And places them within what remains of the book. The next day, at the bank, the clock reads noon. Bemis places the "Next Window, Please" sign, opens a filing cabinet, and takes out his lunch bag, a book, and a newspaper. He walks down behind the teller windows, goes downstairs, turns to look behind him, taps the banister, and heads for the bank vault. He pushes the gate inward, pulls the heavy door behind him, looks back and forth out the opening, then closes it shut. He sits on the floor of the vault and reads a book. Puts the book down and picks up the newspaper. The front page headline? H-bomb capable of total destruction. He puts the paper aside and looks on the floor at his pocket watch, which reads 12:24. Then the glass breaks on the watch. The vault shakes and Bemis falls to the floor. He lies on his back. Bemis picks himself up. His glasses have slid down his nose. He leans on the gate and reaches for the vault door. He feels the door's metal framework and slowly pushes the door open. The glasses now dangling from one ear. His eyes widen. As his glasses come back on, a fuzzy blur comes into focus, revealing a haphazard pile of wooden beams at the foot of the stairs. He lowers his hands from his glasses, slowly steps out of the vault, approaches the stairs, makes his way up, steps around a steel column that has fallen across the stairs, reaches the landing on the main floor. He continues through into the remains of the bank, now cluttered with rubble. Slides through a doorway where the door, now off its hinges, leans at an angle. Knocks over a stray wood scrap. He threads his way through a jumble of ruined office furniture and building materials. He leans on an overturned desk.
I can only tell you.
With a start, Bemis stands up straight.
A constant remembrance that a bank, like a political office, is a public trust. These things are of the essence.
Bemis peeks over the desk.
These things are basic, above all things. Just the quality.
Sticking out from underneath, a hand grasping the remote control for a tape recorder. Sparks fly from the tape recorder. Bemis turns away from the desk, stumbles back to the doorway. Proceeds through what was the row of teller windows. Past clouds of dust. Turns a corner and looks at the wreckage outdoors. Only a scattering of walls remain of where once were buildings. He crouches below a tangle of fallen wooden beams. Holds his hands over his mouth and looks back and forth. He walks outside.
Seconds, minutes, hours. They crawl by on hands and knees for Mr. Henry Bemis, who looks for a spark in the ashes of a dead world. A telephone connected to nothingness. A neighborhood bar, a movie, a baseball diamond, a hardware store. The mailbox of what was once his house and is now a rubble. They lie at his feet as battered monuments to what was but is no more.
Helen!
He stands astride a ridge of broken stone.
Where are you?
Mr. Henry Bemis on an 8-hour tour of a graveyard.
He stands in place and slowly turns around to survey the devastation in all directions.
They're all dead. It must be. Everybody's dead except me. I'm all right. Why am I all right? I was right there in the middle of the vault. I was down in the vault. That's why I'm alive. I was down in the... Think of it is, though. Think of it is. I'm not at all sure that I want to be alive.
He encounters the broken sign for Smith's Grocery, sets up a makeshift table with a couple of cans and a candle.
Well, I'm not going to starve to death anyway. Lots of food. Food enough to last for years and years and years.
He reaches over to a tilted shelf and grabs a cracker from an opened box.
All the food I can eat. All the food. And more too.
Tosses the cracker fragment from his hand. He sits on a torn sofa, holding a cigarette in one hand. Lays his head down on the sofa cushion and pulls his jacket over him as a blanket. Takes his glasses off and rests them on the top edge of the sofa.
Let's see. The very worst part is being alone. Is this how it's going to be? Just sitting around day after day, eating, smoking a cigarette, reading the same half of a newspaper over and over.
He dozes off. Later, he trembles awake, blinks his eyes, reaches around for his glasses, puts them back on, sits up, gets up off the sofa, adjusts his tie, puts his jacket back on, smooths his hair with his fingers, turns his head, makes a dash towards a car, opens the passenger door, goes in, and slides over to the driver's seat. He rests his head on the steering wheel. Opens the driver's side door and gets out.
Someone there? Please, someone! Is someone there? Someone! No, that doesn't make any difference. No, it doesn't make a bit of difference. It's quite all right. This is solitude. I've never had much solitude. I have enough to occupy my mind and my time. I have enough food, and I'm really very fortunate.
Nodding his head,
yes, I'm really
quickly up and down.
Extremely fortunate.
Help. He turns and looks around.
Help.
In a circle.
Someone, please! Someone!
He takes halting
please.
Steps away from the car.
Someone.
He strolls across the boundless field of rubble. Trips over a boulder, reaches a sign reading Sporting Goods. Among the pile of random objects, a cash register, skis, rifles. He knocks over a display case, steps through the assortment of merchandise on the ground, picks up a pistol, holds it up, and examines it. Sits down on the ground, and shivers.
If it just weren't for the loneliness, if it just weren't for the sameness, if there were just something to do.
Punching his left fist on his thigh.
Do.
He lifts the pistol.
Oh, I'm sure I'll be forgiven for this, the way things are. I know I'll be forgiven.
Points it at his head, positions his finger on the trigger. Then he sees a remnant bearing the words, Public Library. He drops the pistol, sees the wide concrete steps leading up to the broken columns in front of a fragment of a wall. He stops at the concrete column identifying the library, wades through a heap of stones and bricks, climbs up the concrete steps, where, strewn amidst the wreckage, lies a pile of books.
Collected works of Dickens?
He takes another couple of steps and gets down on all fours.
Collected works of George Bernard Shaw?
Another couple of steps, and he picks up a volume.
Poems by Browning, Shelley, Keats.
He tosses it on the pile and continues.
Great dramas of the world.
To a shaky bookcase.
Books, books, all the books I'll need.
He sweeps the books off the shelves onto an accumulating mound.
All the books I'll ever want. Shelley, Shakespeare,
hangs on to another loose bookcase.
All the books I want. All the books.
Sits on the mound and opens a book. Later, books are arranged in several stacks.
January, February, March, April, May. This year, the next year.
He walks down the steps.
And the year after.
Past more stacks.
And the year after that. And the year after that.
Clutching five books in his arms, he sits down. Puts down the five books. Picks up the top book from a nearby stack. Flips it open and smiles. Holds it against his chest. Then notices a large clock lying on the ground.
And the best thing, the very best thing of all, is there's time now. There's all the time I need and all the time I want.
Embracing the clock
time,
by its rim.
Time, time.
Then sitting up.
Ah, there's time enough at last.
He looks down at a book on the ground, leans over to pick it up, and his glasses fall onto the concrete. The lenses are shattered. Even the frame of the glasses appears as an indistinct blur. Feeling with his hand, he finds the book, and then the glasses. He picks up the glasses and dislodges what glass fragments remained.
That's not fair. That's not fair at all. There was time now.
Standing up.
There was all the time I needed. That's not fair. That's not fair.
The best laid plans of mice and men, and Henry Bemis. The small man in the glasses who wanted nothing but time. Henry Bemis, now just a part of a smashed landscape. Just a piece of the rubble. Just a fragment of what man has deeded to himself. Mr. Henry Bemis, in the Twilight Zone.
Credits. Directed by John Brom. Teleplay by Rod Serling, based on a short story by Lynn Venable. Produced by Buck Houghton. Executive producer for Cayuga Productions, Rod Serling. Starring Burgess Meredith. With Vaughn Taylor, Jacqueline DeWitt, Leela Bliss. Music composed and conducted by Leith Stevens. Director of photography, George T. Clemens. Production manager, Ralph W. Nelson. Art directors, George W. Davis, William Ferrari. Assistant director, Edward Denault. Casting, Mildred Goose. Film editor, Bill Mosher. Set decorations, Henry Grace, Rudy Butler. Sound, Frank Melton, Gene Valentino. Animated title by UPA. Copyright 1959 by Cayuga Productions, Inc. Filmed at Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer Studios. Audio description by Lou Lasher.